Today, I want to talk about the Buddha's enlightenment a little bit, since it is Enlightenment Day. Here's a thing that Reverend Master G.U. Kennett used to say. She said that the Buddha didn't set out to find enlightenment. He set out to find the solution to the problem of suffering. He set out to understand suffering and to do something about it. And in the process, he awakened his mind. He found enlightenment. She used to say, it's like the person who invented the hammer. Likely as not, the person wanted to break something, break a rock or whatever. And so, in the process of trying to break a rock, affixed another rock to a stick and invented the hammer. He didn't set out to invent the hammer. He set out to break a rock. And I think that's a useful thing to keep in mind as we explore the path of Buddhism. We might think, oh, I want to find the enlightenment of the Buddha. I want to find that experience of awakening and have some idea about what that experience of awakening means or what it will feel like or something like that. And in some sense, we desire it as an object, something that we pursue, a feeling that we want to have. And that may be the case. That may be something that we encounter, some feeling we might encounter. But it is in many ways much bigger than that. And by having that narrow focus on it, we miss the potential of the bigness of it. So, and also, practically speaking, there is the question of how to get to that experience. And in what River Master G.U. is talking about is a clue to that. We get to that experience by working on the suffering that presents itself to us in our life right now. Today we celebrated the festival of the Buddha's enlightenment, and we use that word enlightenment. I'm not sure what that is a translation of. It's not necessarily a translation of nirvana. That word means to cease. And to cease what? To cease our pursuit of those things which create suffering. But enlightenment is an interesting word because, and sometimes we use the word awakening, because it implies not some kind of fundamentally different experience than we already have, but simply the illumination of our present life, the illumination of our present experience. We awaken to the reality of our present life, our present experience. I use that word reality. There used to be, and maybe it still is, a phrase that people use where you hear someone say, get real. And what that means in that kind of colloquial context is sort of ground yourself in the unpleasant reality, the unpleasant truth of your life as it is right now. Wake up to the unpleasant kind of truth that you're kind of avoiding. Get real. Don't live off in your fantasy of how things ought to be. And there's a kind of implication that getting real is going to be awakening to the nasty, brutish, and short quality of life. And it may be that that's the case when we're talking about awakening to the reality of life, but it may be that what we awaken to is some kind of unpleasant truth about ourselves and about the world. And that is kind of a reality of life, that we sometimes have to see, well, we ultimately will need to look at the consequences of our actions from ignorance, and that's going to be suffering. When we act from ignorance, there's going to be suffering, and so part of our awakening is looking at that and coming to terms with it. But there is more to the real world than just the negative consequences of our actions. Traditionally, Enlightenment Day is celebrated on the 7th or 8th of December in Japan, and that follows what's called a Rohatsu retreat, a Rohatsu session. And Rohatsu is the Buddha's enlightenment, and there's always a week-long session, S-E-S-H-I-N, Sesshin, which is translated as a searching of the heart retreat. And the monks in a larger monastery will always get together at the end of the training term in the winter for the Rohatsu retreat, and at the end of the spring training term in the spring for the Denkoe retreat, the transmission of the light retreat in April, and there'll be a 7-day retreat. So at the end of the retreat, they celebrate Enlightenment Day, and it commemorates, the 7 days commemorate the amount of time when the Buddha finally determined that asceticism wasn't working, self-indulgence didn't work, and he was just going to sit still in meditation. And he sat for 7 days and then was awakened. So, all kind of bound up again in this pursuit of enlightenment, of awakening, is the path and the impulse to deal with suffering and all of that. At the beginning of the retreat, of these retreats, these sessions, the monks recite, or someone recites for the monks right at the first day of meditation, the first period of meditation, a thing called the Great Wish. And part of it goes like this: we, the disciples, are as yet unable in many ways to recognize the Buddha's being, form, features, and radiance. May the Buddha manifest them to us so that we may be able to recognize them wherever they may be seen. May we be able to behold them as well as to see Avalokiteshvara and other bodhisattvas, and all that is pertaining to the world that is the real world, such as purity, grandeur, glory, radiance, brilliance, and wonder. So, whenever someone says, get real, I think not only of that awakening to the negative consequences of our actions, but also I think of this opening phrase to the Great Wish, or this phrase from the Great Wish, which points to a real world which partakes of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and partakes of purity, grandeur, glory, radiance, brilliance, and wonder. So those are also characteristics of the real. And part of what we awaken to as we practice the Dharma. Because we're all caught up in our habitual patterns, our habitual way of looking at the world, we miss those things. We we are as yet unable in many ways to recognize the Buddha's being, form, and features and radiance. And so as we practice, as we go along in our practice, as we address suffering, and that's what I mean by all caught up in our opinions and habitual ways of doing things, as we gradually let go of our suffering, as we gradually deal with that, this other world, these other dimensions of the world begin to be apparent. They begin to make themselves known. We begin to awaken to them. We begin to turn on the light. We begin to enlighten ourselves. One of my teachers, it's a common thing where there is this notion of an awakening experience being sort of like a flash of lightning or the light switch coming on, that the room is then immediately illuminated. But other people have likened it also, or there's another way of going, which is this sort of dimmer switch approach, where gradually over time the dimmer switch gets moved up and we begin to be aware of an increasing sort of enlightening process going on. It may well be that, I think probably this is the case, that all along there's been that dimmer switch moving up, and then at some point we suddenly become aware that that dimmer switch has been moving. So, again, back to the matter of the hammer, it's not so much, we don't need to so much worry about whether we have an instant flash of awakening or whether we have a dimmer switch going up. It's more just that we can, practically speaking, focus on doing our practice, working on our minds, our bodies, our life right now as it is, and applying the practice to that, and entrust ourselves to the practice. And entrusting ourselves to the practice, we are living out the faith that these aspects of the real world really are there, and that we will come to know them, we will come to awaken them. The Buddha was as we are now. We will be as they in the future. That's what the Buddha taught. And if we continue to practice, if we continue to have faith in what the Buddha taught, then eventually we will come to know the awakening of the Buddha. We will know the enlightenment of the Buddha. So, that's pretty much what I had to say today. Apart from happy Enlightenment Day, it's a pleasure, as I say, to get together with y'all and celebrate the festival. And I have this kind of, well, I could add this. I tend to be a person who gets all caught up in the ideas in my head. And I was reading in the Majjhima Nikaya, I can't remember the section, the middle-length sayings from the Pali Canon. The Buddha was talking about the problem of getting all entangled in the thicket of views. The thicket of views. Like this bramble, this blackberry patch of views. And how you get kind of caught up in that thicket of views and you get stuck in there. You can't really get out. And I was reading along there. I can remember the scene. And I thought, I had this kind of really strong like feeling like, oh, the Buddha is talking, like Shakyamuni Buddha is talking directly to me. He knows my mind and is talking, he knows the state of my mind and is talking directly to me. It's sort of startling. And I think I've always kind of just appreciated the Buddha and his effort and all of that, but there was something quite personal about that. And so for me, there's a kind of personal appreciation for what the Buddha did, his sacrifice and his effort and his achievement. And so getting together for a festival like this and decorating the altar and kind of doing it up with some extra music and whatnot, it's always something I quite appreciate being able to do.
I find that, I got thinking of you, as I thought, I find anything that gets you out of your head is a good thing. And the ceremony does that. In a way, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I can sit down in meditation and bounce around on the edges of the boxes of my head. You know.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And if I'm fortunate, I kind of, the box opens up a bit, you know. But the ceremony, if you give yourself to it, you know, it, you know, in a sense, has no walls. And it's kind of, it's different.
Yeah.
It's a different approach. So if you, I would say if you just had the, if I just had the meditation only, you know, but I think the ceremony, adds a whole element of different way of looking at things or training.
Yeah, there's something quite nice about the ceremonial in that respect. It's kind of detailed. There are other people there that you are in some ways responsible to. Like if you go left and everybody's going right, it's gonna kind of stand out and call attention to you or whatever. It really requires you to get out of your head and just pay attention to what's kind of going on around you, and to kind of just let go of whatever it is you're pursuing and just be there and be with the other people and stuff like that. So, yeah, I quite agree. I quite appreciate you bringing that up, and it's a kind of an excellent point about the ceremonial. Sometimes people, because of our history in the West, we don't really like ceremonial so much, or we can resist it, like it's, I don't know, from Christianity or whatever. But over the years for me, that's completely kind of shed, and that kind of resistance or that kind of problem with it is completely shed. It's because of that very thing, that it's just another way to practice meditation, but it helps me to get out of my thicket of views, you know, in an important way.
But there's also this much aligned word mindfulness. I have that when I work, because I have to be there, otherwise I hurt myself.
Yeah. Yeah, just being wholeheartedly present in a thing, and like you're talking about with work, that element of danger kind of focuses the mind. It kind of makes you kind of aware of what's going on, and you have to be wholeheartedly present there. And the ceremonial again does the same thing. Like, it's fairly well. They said at Sojiji, Reverend Master Jiu used to say, the temple where she was trained in Japan. She said, "You never really know the ceremonial until you've made a mistake in front of the emperor." It's fairly small stakes, but when you make a mistake in our little sangha here, everybody kind of knows it, and Trinity will kind of appreciate. And I'm not trying to separate you out. Anybody who's stepped up and been willing to take responsibility is doing a bodhisattva service. But part of the hard part of it is everybody knows when you've made a mistake, and that being able to make a mistake in public is really great for training. It's really great for just letting go of the self and then being willing to get back up and continue to try is really excellent. It helps to let go of the self, but it also helps to focus the mind. We don't want to make a mistake, and it's nice if we don't, but it does help to... I used to do this thing where I would be the precentor's assistant for the ceremonies at the Abbey, and there'd be 35 or 40 monks in the ceremony and 20 or 30 lay people around, and I'd be in the loft ringing all the bells and gongs, and there'd be a precentor on the ceremony floor, and they'd be intoning the scriptures and singing the offertory. And if you made a mistake up there in the loft with those gongs and bells, you're signaling the ceremony, you're kind of helping it move along, so people have to hear what you do. You can't just kind of go gong and hope that nobody notices. So you have to kind of whack that thing, and you whack it at the wrong time, and everybody goes the wrong direction. I remember doing a ceremony where we did the adoration of the Buddha's relics, which is a short scripture that we do. You recite the whole thing through, and then you recite the beginning of it, of the beginning, like a quarter of the thing. And that usually works out fine. That's all we do. But in this particular ceremony, we do three recitations of the adoration of the Buddha's relics in back to back. And so you do one recitation, and you're supposed to do one recitation, and then do a quarter of the recitation, and then stop, and then start again, one recitation and a quarter of the recitation, and stop. But somehow I got confused. I was quite tired and got confused and stopped it before the repeat. And it was just a horrible muddle. We were just like, I don't know what happened, but anyway, it was very embarrassing. So I think we ended up, I just stopped the music and we just sang it a cappella then from then on. But it was very interesting, and I just noticed every time I'd make a mistake, then I'd have to kind of wait and think, okay, they come in threes, because for whatever reason. So then the second one, then the third one, but anyway, sorry, I'd go on.
I can't remember, something happened once. I was standing next to somebody and it got goofed up, and the comment was, there's something human about it. You know what I mean?
Mm.
You know, if you're trying that perfection, you know what I mean? And that becomes the bar, which you try to do. You try to do the best job you can. But these elements add a little, in my mind, the human,
yeah,
the human element. Yeah.
Yeah, and our humanity does not stand against the awakening to the reality of life. It does not stand against the radiance, the grandeur, the brilliance, the glory, the wonder. We think that it does, and that is a big obstacle for many of us, but just our ordinary humanity is not in conflict with that. And it's a great relief when we can come to begin to accept that. It's okay if we're not perfect.
There was a very famous sculptor who said, sometimes in my work, I see something and I see it as a mistake. But if I think it'll work with it, I'd rather leave it, because, the human is more important than perfection.
Yeah.
So you always almost like that human little element in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know that I have a choice in it, but it's just like this thing when I build and fix things, and almost always when I go around and look at the thing that I've built or fixed, I can kind of pick out a little thing. It's like, oh, there's a little sign that Reverend Leon did this project. It's like something was cut off just a little bit too short, or there's a gap somewhere, or something like that, and it's always kind of something, and I, anyway, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, the being human part is very precious, for sure, but it's it's tough because well, we're supposed to let go of everything, which means letting go of being a human. But then something happens, and being a human happens. Mm-hmm. It's like you're saying, it's completely natural to practice.
Yeah.
And I really find a lot of importance in the sangha, mm-hmm. because when I'm just by myself in my own room meditating or practicing in whatever fashion, there's no like outside accountability.
Right.
And so it's easy to get like lost in my own selfishness.
Yeah.
Right. I really enjoyed today when I was reading and singing, I'd get so caught up in that because I'd never done it before and mm-hmm. I didn't know the tones or whatever. And then I would be like, oh, things are happening. Like, I also need to be aware of everyone else.
That's right.
You know? So I don't get necessarily, I don't get that when I'm by myself.
Right.
I don't get that whole like, oh, I need to be thinking of everyone else.
Right.
I get all caught up. And then when you say, like, it's natural, like, it just comes out of us, the practice. It's not like we have to force it to be something different than we are. This is what actually naturally happens.
Mm-hmm.
Then I start to think, okay, well, all the things that make me act how I act anyways, those aren't necessarily pure influences. They just are influences.
Yeah.
But instead of like saying I don't like that and I don't want that and running away into meditation,
mm-hmm.
Being in the sangha makes me realize, oh, I have to accept that and let it go and just let whatever happens naturally happen anyways.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, and in that process, we see what impulses lead to suffering. And if you're still and aware, you will feel that suffering quite intensely, and there will be what arises naturally is a wish to not create suffering. And so we work hard at, even in that place of acceptance, restraining those impulses that create suffering. Like that thing that you describe about singing and being aware at the same time that there's something else going on you need to pay attention to, too. There's a kind of accountability in that. We realize that when we, part of the awakening of that is the recognition that when we get all wrapped up in our own little world, our own little mind, this is why we sit with our eyes open. When we get all wrapped up in our own little mind, our own little world, we, from that all wrapped up in place, we create suffering. And so part of the thing about practice is learning that as well. The natural activity that is talked about in Dogen's Rules of Meditation is not just following our impulses, but is actually, what he means by natural activity is the activity, the movement of Buddha nature in our lives. And so he's referring to something that's a little deeper than just what comes naturally. Although a lot of our practice is just following what comes naturally. One of my teachers made a point of telling me at a certain point, we really need to look with a bit of a critical eye at that process of just doing what comes naturally, because there can be habits in there that are that actually perpetuate our suffering. that increase our suffering and increase the suffering of others. So what you describe, though, is exactly the process that we're all going through, where we associate with the practice, and the Sangha is one element of the practice. We associate with the practice, and it begins to illuminate ways, because of that kind of accountability, it begins to illuminate ways that we weren't aware before of creating suffering. And so we can begin to restrain those and let, in some sense, the real natural activity come through. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, like something could be so habitual that it seems natural.
Right.
But really it's not.
Right, yeah, it's not.
It's just a result of our
conditioning. Right. Yeah. And so, and there's not a, it's not that there's a judgment about that. We're not, and we're not trying to kind of say that a person is bad because of that kind of behavior. It's more just, okay, as we sit still in there, we begin to see those patterns in a deeper way and begin to relinquish them, to let them go and not pursue them. And that process is what results from doing practice.
Yeah, I guess it's just tough. Personally, I find difficulty in practice because, well, it's giving up what we think is right and just doing what we've been told is right by people who have helped us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we trust them. But it's just tough because, I mean, if you take it all away, then you'd be, I mean, at least with my idea of what my practice is, if I go to the ideal that I see the Buddha's preaching, then I have to give up things. I have to give up all my desires. Right? So, what if I desire to, you know, like, make art, or, like, I have these things in me that I desire to do, but could those things not be natural? Is that what they're getting at? It's like, hey, even though you think that you desiring to be an artist or something is natural, like, actually, it's not. Turn the light back in and find out what it really is.
Well, first, when I talk about letting go, I have this example that I like to use where it's like my relationship to this chair I'm sitting in. Maybe I've showed you this before. Some of you have probably seen it before. It's like this chair that I'm sitting in, this little straight-back chair that I'm sitting in. I'm not holding on to it right now. I've let it go, but I am sitting in it. I can make use of it. I'm sitting here. Because I'm not letting go of it, I can stand up and walk around. I can leave the room, all that stuff. If I'm holding on to it, I'm now sitting back down in it. If I'm holding on to it while I'm sitting in it, it doesn't really make that much difference. It's a little bit of extra tension, but I'm still sitting in it, still functioning. If I'm holding on to it when I stand up, then it becomes a problem. Like I, you know, can't walk around with this chair stuck in my backside. So part of the thing we're learning how to do in meditation is to just let go. And that's not pushing things away. It's not grasping after things. It's just letting go. And now I'm just sitting back down. I can sit here in this chair. I've let go of the chair. And that means I can fully function holding onto this chair. Without holding onto this chair, I can sit here. I'm unimpeded by it. I'm unimpeded by my own holding on. I can sit in it when I need to sit in it. I can stand up and leave the room when I need to leave the room and leave the chair behind. Everything in our life is pretty much like that. some of the things that we hold on to are things which create suffering. I hold on to being anger, you know, holding on to anger at someone, or I hold on to resentment, and I'm holding on to that thing. And the resentment creates suffering, but also the holding on creates suffering. So I teach myself to let go of resentment. It arises, I see it, I feel it. Sometimes I may act on it, and if I act on it, then that increases suffering. But if I don't act on it, then that doesn't, then that diminishes suffering. But I've, letting go of it doesn't get rid of it, it just means that it arises and passes away. All too often, if there's something like that in our minds, like the habit of resentment, the more I let go of it, oftentimes, eventually, the less it will arise. It just won't be produced anymore. Sometimes when I let go of something, it arises much more intensely for a while, until I've seen why it's arising. Some things I let go of, like I've said before, I like to juggle. I let go of juggling. I don't identify with that. That's not part of who I am. Or more appropriately, baking. I love to bake. I love to cook and all that stuff. It arises in my mind that I love that. But like lately, I can't eat wheat, I can't eat yeast, I can't eat all these things, so I don't bake very often. Sometimes the desire to bake arises, and I allow it to pass away. I don't have to bake. But sometimes it arises, and I think, oh, it'd be nice to make something for the Sangha, and so I make something for the Sangha. See what I'm getting at?
It's not really a desire, I want to bake. It's more like, it's just like an intention to, like, create something for someone else. But is that still desire? Like a desire to make something for the Sangha?
Sometimes it's like that, yeah.
But it doesn't have to be. Is that what you're saying? It could arise naturally without you desiring it.
I don't try to, sometimes the idea that a thing would be good to do arises, and there are multiple reasons for that arising. It may be that I just like to do it. What is important, though, is that, like, I was at the Abbey for the conclave recently, and right at the beginning, I was asked to make some cinnamon rolls. The monks like these cinnamon rolls that I bake. And so I was asked, you know, sort of informally, if I wanted to make some cinnamon rolls. So I went into this process of figuring out when to make how to make the cinnamon rolls. I was feeling kind of tired, though, and the chief cook was not so... Well, actually, no, they were fine about it. It was fine. But what happened was I got sick. And so it became clear that I just didn't have the wherewithal to make the cinnamon rolls. So I had to let that go. And the thing about that was looking within and not letting my desire to make the cinnamon rolls... There was a kind of coincidence of events. Probably I became good at making cinnamon rolls because I wanted to do it. Well, because I had a job that required me to do that anyway. So the whole complicated kind of thing about that. I'm not so keen about taking all that apart. It's just, okay, here is a situation that arises because of past circumstances. Someone asked me to make cinnamon rolls. I like to make cinnamon rolls. I can do it, all of these things. But in the midst of that, it became clear, the sense arose in me, it would not be good for me to make cinnamon rolls at this point. So then I set it aside. And it is because of all the effort that I went to in the past to let go of that desire that I was able to do that with equanimity. If I'm still clinging to that desire, then I might get upset because I'm disappointed because I couldn't make the cinnamon rolls. See what I'm...
Or feel bad.
Or feel bad.
But you just no, this isn't the time.
This isn't the
place.
Time.
And yeah.
In that, I have to be honest with myself, and I see a little bit of disappointment arises. Or like when I talk about, when I'm sitting here talking to you about baking these cinnamon rolls, and I say, oh, I'm good at it, this little pride arises in my, this little feeling of, oh yeah, I really am kind of good at it. But I have to notice that in my mind and be still in it and own it, and like in the sense of not try to push it away, not try to make it into something different. There it is. I notice that feeling. Huh? There it is. More training to be done by me. I can let go of that. See what I'm getting at? So the effort is really to just be still in there, to be honest and to see clearly what's going on and to ask ourselves what is good to do. And sometimes what's good to do, I mean, maybe you're artistic and you need to work in the world, so you want to pursue that and develop some skill that you can make some money at. I think that's similar to where Virginia is. Maybe not.
Somewhat, yeah.
There's, anyway, Virginia happens to be an artist. So, and so is Gary. So, but there's different reasons for doing these things, and it's not that we become... The important thing about the talk, the discussion about being human, is it's not that we become some kind of faceless, mindless drone. We're still fully human beings. We have to function in the world. We do what we need to do. The question is, how can we bring that spirit of letting go in there so that it doesn't, so that we're not getting all upset or worried or causing other people suffering? See what I'm saying? So there's no... There are a few things in life that are completely prohibited to us. It'd be better if you didn't kind of work in a slaughterhouse. It'd be better if you didn't work in the skin trades. It would be better if you didn't sell drugs, lead a life of crime for your livelihood. But apart from that, there's really not any prohibition against doing any of those things. You just... can find a way to bring practice to them and that spirit of letting go in there. And at some, like, I'd love to read novels. When I was a layperson, when I was a kid, I would lose myself in books all the time. I would lose myself in novels all the time for as long as I can remember. At a certain point in my practice, I thought, I kind of need to rein that in. So, for about 8 years as a layperson, I set aside reading novels. I didn't read novels for an extended period of time. Later on, that didn't seem to be so much of a problem, so I started reading novels again. Just, we find a way to work with things, and that may arise in practice. And then, sorry, you did raise another question, which is, that difficulty of doing, of following the teaching, of doing a thing that we've heard is good to do and which we don't necessarily know yet is good to do for ourselves. And yes, that is a difficult thing. It's especially important in that to ask ourselves whether what we're asked to do is preceptual, whether it is within the scope of what is preceptual, you know, it's moral, and that it doesn't, that we don't compromise our own personal integrity. Although sometimes what's suggested that we do will come close to that. My teacher used to say, be careful of when someone is asking for your BMW, your body, your money, and your will. If there's a teacher who is asking you to do some compromising thing with your body, sexual kind of interaction or something like that, your money, if they're asking you to give more of your money than would be good, and if they're trying to trying to control your will. So those are three areas that we need to be particularly careful of and to be looking at over time. Again, awareness and mindfulness is in there if there's any kind of sense that someone's trying to force you to do something in practice, it's usually not so great. Sometimes as we go along and we develop a relationship with a teacher who we trust, we may have to explore the margins of those things to see what's going on. But again, there is a line that we don't want to cross in there. And so we need to be quite careful of that. Does that make some sense? Mm-hmm. And always, it's the Buddha's advice is, you know, prove it true for yourself. Try it if it's perceptual, if it doesn't compromise your integrity, and see how it goes. See whether it actually does help you for a while. Try it for a while and then see. All right. Well, I've blathered on probably a satisfactory amount. Anything else? Okay, well, thank you very much. Happy Enlightenment Day.